KRWG News This Week, I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. The New York-based First Street Foundation published a report this year that was largely overlooked. That might change after the last few weeks, which saw dozens of people die in Tennessee from unprecedented flooding. Two people also died in El Paso flooding recently, and southern New Mexico saw devastating flood damage. More on that coming up. But what about that research from First Street Foundation? It says sea levels and extreme weather could cause $20 billion of flood damage to at-risk U.S. homes this year alone, rising to $32 billion in the next 30 years. This isn't a new problem. The cost of flood damage was approximately $17 billion annually between 2010 and 2018, according to testimony from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Flooding has devastated households in southern Doñana County, leaving residents with thousands of dollars in damage and officials scrambling to repair infrastructure. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
Mercedes Esquivel Herrera's 100-year-old home was built room by room by her grandfather.
I was born and raised here, all my brothers, and it's like a 100-year-old house, and I've done a lot of work to it and try to keep it up.
But historic August rains devastated her Anthony home, leaving one wall collapsed and other rooms with cracks and holes.
It was very hard to believe it. I mean, I walked in and I started crying, and I still do, just to walk in there and see it, you know, and it affected me a lot, especially when they told me it wasn't safe for me to stay there, that I should just find somewhere to stay.
The 71-year-old moved into a borrowed camper on the property. Living on Social Security, she is unable to fix the damage without outside help. Her daughter is raising money for her through the online platform GoFundMe. Herrera's message to government officials is clear. While the rain may have stopped for now, better infrastructure is needed to prevent future disasters.
We need help. We need all the help we can get. All the people have been affected by these storms, you know, not just myself, but I'm speaking for everybody, because there's a lot of people that need help right now.
Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham declared a state of emergency in Doñana County due to the heavy rainfall and flooding. County Office of Emergency Management Manager Stephen Lopez says money provided by that declaration will fund public infrastructure projects as mandated by the state constitution.
We do not know what funds will be received from the state or the federal government, but by law, all of the funds that we receive have to go only for repairs to public infrastructure. So that'll be repairs to the dams, the roads, repairs to the wastewater utility system that was submerged.
Lopez says the county is still trying to identify just how many residents are without flood insurance. While the number is unknown, Lopez says he has seen an increase in residents dropping flood insurance due to recent infrastructure improvements.
One of the linchpins in this whole situation is a lot of people, because the dams had been improved, dropped their flood insurance. And if they still had their flood insurance, there's a whole lot more we can do with FEMA to help those people.
The county is currently exploring the use of additional money, like the American Rescue Plan Act Rental Assistance Program. While that could help renters, homeowners will have to find other means to repair damage.
So we went in on the very first day and identified the structures that were at most risk and talked individually with those homeowners. We explained the risks to them. That's now entirely their responsibility. By law, we cannot do anything more.
Doñana County is focused on monitoring dams and making repairs. Officials are concerned about two La Union dams, one of which overflowed. But they're also worried about other dams that can't hold large amounts of stormwater.
The Alvarez formed perfectly, but it completely filled up with mud behind the dam. So it has no rainwater holding capacity right now. And the Gardner Dam, even further south by Santa Teresa, is a failed dam structure. It was made by farmers back in the 60s, we believe. And that dam is actively leaking water underneath, which means it is close to a catastrophic failure. And if it goes, that water could be a wall of water traveling over 3 miles.
Lopez says pumping efforts to empty some of the water within Gardner Dam were massive, pumping the equivalent of an entire residential swimming pool every minute.
because it was not properly designed. We've been having to pump the water out from behind that dam. They finished up finally getting the water down 10 feet below the top of the dam.
Residents within Doña Ana County aren't alone. Nationally, more than 41 million Americans are at risk of flooding each year. According to the FEMA climate change report, floodplains are expected to increase 45% within the next 100 years, largely attributed to climate change. Lopez says changes in floodplains are just one reason homeowners should purchase flood insurance.
You may not technically be in a floodplain, but the floodplain may come in. So having that flood insurance not only helps you in the rebuilding process, it also gives us many more tools that we can then bring in to assist.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
Well, as you just heard in that report, climate scientists predict a significant jump in extreme weather events over the next 20 or 30 years. There's confirmation of that in a new report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The New Mexico News Connection's Roz Brown reports.
The report shows efforts to curb fossil fuel emissions have been delayed so long, the intensification of global warming over the next 30 years cannot be avoided. Nonetheless, senior climate scientist Elisa Acco with the Environmental Defense Fund says it's never too late to act.
But the sooner we do act and the faster we go, the better off we will be. Because every increment of extra warming we avoid helps reduce the intensity and frequency of extreme events and lowers the risks of catastrophic outcomes.
New Mexico's Environment Department is working to finalize new regulations to reduce methane and air pollution from oil and gas operations by implementing rules to eliminate routine flaring and reduce natural gas waste. The climate report says extreme weather events, including heat waves and forest fires, such as those on the West Coast, are expected to worsen and become more frequent. Lisa DeVille with the Dakota Resource Council lives on the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation in North Dakota.
This year, smoke from wildfires has been filling our air and damaging our lungs. These impacts will only get worse if we continue to extract fossil fuels and spew carbon and methane pollution into the air.
Rick Duke is a special assistant to the president on climate change. He says the report quashes any remaining debate about the urgent need to slash methane pollution, especially from sectors such as oil and gas, which alone accounts for at least 25% of the warming. He notes, however, that technology already exists to cut those emissions by 75%.
Even without considering climate stability, public health, or agricultural productivity benefits, most of these methane reduction strategies are highly affordable, since they convert methane from a waste stream into valuable products like electricity.
The Environmental Protection Agency is set to propose rules next month for reducing methane emissions from new and existing oil and gas operations nationwide, which analysis shows could reduce emissions by 65%. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
KRWG News this week, I'm Fred Martino. El Paso Congresswoman Veronica Escobar visited Fort Bliss to get a firsthand look at the operation set up to receive thousands of refugees from Afghanistan. The Congresswoman talked with KTEP's Angela Kocherka.
What I want to share with you, what I saw today, and share with the American people and our region, that there really is an extraordinary story to tell. And I feel incredibly privileged to have been on Fort Bliss and to have been able to talk to some Afghan families. I was able to thank every single soldier that I met. I met some really extraordinary American service members. Every single service member told me how proud they were to be a part of this mission. Every single soldier told me what a privilege it is to help care for these families. I really feel tremendous emotion having left Fort Bliss. Multiple soldiers told me how high morale is on the ground at Fort Bliss and what a joy it is to be able to participate. As I thanked them, I told them that they are taking part of a really important moment in American history as we welcome our allies, as we demonstrate to the world that we are a country of goodwill, that we are a country that will keep her promises, that we are a country of compassion. And that's who we as a region here in the El Paso Las Cruces, Ciudad Juarez region, that's who we've always been. So in many ways, there could not be a better location to receive these vulnerable families. I saw Afghan families, I saw infants, I saw a mom nursing her baby who thanked me. I saw elderly people. I spoke with an interpreter who expressed tremendous gratitude and who fled and left everything with his wife. He's worried about his family that's left behind, family members that did not work for the government. They did not work alongside our American service members, but family that they love and that they're worried about. The American Red Cross is on site. A number of NGOs are on site at Fort Bliss. And the American Red Cross has been really remarkable, really remarkable. And they are working to get tablets and phones so that Afghan families can connect internationally with those that they left behind. I also shared with the military leadership that our caseworkers who are working constantly on the casework to try to do as much as possible, especially as we approach August 31st, I shared with them that if there's any Afghan guests on Fort Bliss, and guests is how our American service members refer to the Afghan refugees in their care. But I said, I let them know that if there are any guests that need casework, that we stand ready to help support. My office has received dozens and dozens of calls, not just from El Paso constituents, but from folks across the country. And they've been working diligently to try to make sure that we do everything possible to help get as many folks out as possible. So these folks are not being detained, right? They're not being detained, but they know that they're key to being able to work. They're key to finding housing, will be in getting this support.
How many refugees can Fort Bliss take in, and are flights coming every day? What's the capacity?
Flights are coming in. I got there right after a flight got there. They're getting at least one or two flights a day. That is going to, they anticipate that's going to speed up. There were fewer than 2,000 people today. I think fewer than 1,200 people today, and they have the capacity, or they will have the capacity, for 10,000. Their contractor right now is still clearing land, preparing more tents in anticipation of more families and individuals.
That was El Paso Congresswoman Veronica Escobar talking with KTEP's Angela Kocherka. At least 19 people have died in tribal jails overseen by the federal government since 2016, according to an investigation by NPR and the Mountain West News Bureau. As part of our ongoing coverage of mistreatment of inmates on reservations, the Bureau is highlighting some of the victims and the circumstances around their deaths, which reflect decades of mismanagement, neglect, and poor training. Here's the Mountain West News Bureau's Nate Hedgie.
Keith Skunk Cap's grief began with a phone call. He was out bowling with some friends on a Thursday night in Cutbank, Montana. He was having a good time, grabbing a beer at the bar, when his cell phone rang.
I get a call from my brother Raymond, and he tells me that my sister's gone. I said, "You better be lying."
But he wasn't. Keith's sister, Brandy Skunk Cap, had just died in the federally operated jail on the nearby Blackfeet Reservation.
I broke down and I was like, this can't be true, you know.
Brandy was Keith's little sister, a shy, slight woman with brown hair. When she was a little kid, she loved drawing pictures of eagles and horses. But as she got older, she fell into an addiction to painkillers, methamphetamine, and alcohol. When she lost custody of her four kids, her family says she took a turn for the worse. Keith's wife, Tara Braun.
We could tell it was taking a toll on her body. You can just tell by looking at her. But
what did she look like?
Very small, very frail.
Hair is falling out.
Yeah. teeth were falling out, not the brandy that we were used to seeing.
It was this brandy that was arrested on March 23rd, 2016. Her skin was jaundiced, and 2 weeks prior, she had been in a hospital vomiting blood. She told guards she didn't feel well. The BIA's health and safety standards say guards are supposed to note these ailments on an inmate's intake forms. If a person is sick, they need to be taken to a health clinic. But the correctional officer on duty decided Brandy was healthy enough to stay in the jail.
This lady is really sick.
That's David Mathis. He's a physician and surgeon who specializes in correctional health care. He's also an expert witness in correctional medicine. He reviewed Brandy's jail records, autopsy, and the coroner's report obtained by the Mountain West News Bureau. He says the guards screwed up.
They needed to contact the hospital where she was vomiting blood and find out, get that discharge summary and get some medical professional involved, because this was a very sick lady and needed different drugs to support her.
But she never got those drugs. She never visited a hospital. The next day, Brandy had what appeared to be an alcohol withdrawal seizure as her cellmate watched helplessly. It was captured on surveillance video, but guards missed it. And when they checked on her nearly an hour later, she was unresponsive. Guards had violated at least 2 federal policies here. First, when they failed to check on her regularly and missed the seizure. Then again, when they found her. Instead of giving her immediate first aid, it took 6 minutes before a tribal police officer showed up and began performing CPR. Brandy's sister-in-law, Tara Braun.
She needs help, she needs medical attention, and it was not, they didn't respond to her until it was too late.
Brandy was taken to a hospital where she was pronounced dead about 2 hours after first having the seizure. She's one of at least 5 inmates at tribal jails who have died after guards failed to provide proper medical care and attention. Tribal advocate Brandy Tomhav is a former congressional staffer and member of the Choctaw Nation. She lobbies on behalf of tribes on Capitol Hill. She says the BIA needs to start requiring on-site nurses, paramedics, or doctors at these jails.
You have folks coming in who are being confined without knowing what kinds of infectious disease, chronic conditions, or persistent injuries that they have.
She says that's a recipe for deadly mistakes. The federal government funds healthcare providers in other correctional programs, but chose not to require them in the BIA's tribal jails.
Choices have consequences, and the federal government has chosen to ignore their legal obligation to provide appropriate staffing and programming in the form of medical care inside tribal jails. And that decision has gotten people killed.
But beyond the lack of doctors or nurses at these jails, our investigation has also uncovered that some of the jails themselves are squalid and unsafe. They don't have potable water, the walls are cracked, the heaters are broken. That story in the final part of our series. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie.
Funding for this series made possible in part by the Pulitzer Center and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The foster care crisis in Texas continues to escalate. Kids without proper placements are sleeping in offices or churches. A federal lawsuit is ongoing, and lack of funding is stressing the whole system. Reese Oxner has been covering this story for the Texas Tribune. He talked with KERA's Justin Martin.
Can you describe what it's like for a child in foster care in Texas? You chronicled the story of one kid named Prince Hayward.
Starting with Prince, he spent his whole childhood essentially in foster care or in and out of CPS custody. The first time he ever spent the night on the floor, he was 6 or 7 years old. And from then on, it was just him rotating from facility to facility. Very rarely was he in an actual foster care home with a family. He often was put in residential treatment centers or emergency shelters, or again, on the floor of an office. And so what that does is it's just a lot of instability for a kid. I mean, there is times where he would just get unenrolled from school, wouldn't be going to school, or he would be re-enrolled in another city just to leave in a couple other weeks. And so really at these formative years, you know, psychiatrists I've talked to have said, like, it causes irreparable damage and trauma that can take years of therapy to overcome. And that's why not having those therapeutic treatment centers available for these children is really damaging. And every day that it goes on, it's another day that a child is spending not in a bed they were supposed to be in.
How has COVID-19 complicated things for foster care in Texas?
COVID-19 has also caused some issues with foster families being apprehensive maybe about having kids in their home, especially because you might not have a child who's been vaccinated, or you're not really in control of the history of where that child has been. And so that's exacerbated the issue. I don't have numbers on how that's affected per se, but DFPS officials do say that the COVID-19 pandemic has affected it less than the overall lawsuit and the facilities closing down.
A federal court case against the state was supposed to lead to an overhaul of the foster care system in Texas. What's next? I mean, is there anything the federal government can do to motivate Texas to fix things?
The federal lawsuit has been going on now for 10 years, and it's still ongoing. There isn't necessarily a clear end in sight, because the federal judge in charge of the case levied a series of court orders meant to reform the system, as you said. But numerous times the court has found that the state isn't sufficiently living up to those standards, and that's what's led to the court holding the state in contempt at least twice, and the judge continually talking to officials and saying, we need to do better. We need to keep this change going. And that's why there's a team of people working with the two court-appointed monitors to keep an eye on the system. They operate essentially as watchdogs against the state's foster care system. And so until all the judges' orders have been met, we could see this lawsuit going on for years, potentially.
Reese Oxner is a reporter for the Texas Tribune. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
On the Health Watch this week, amid a new wave of COVID-19 cases, efforts to get people vaccinated have ramped up. But after a year of misinformation, not everyone is ready to get their shot. Texas Tech Public Media's Jamie Lozano reports on one population that's proven harder to reach.
Christy Martinez Garcia and her organization, Los Hermanos Familia, host the annual Vamos a Pescar fishing competition. The event, which gathers the Hispanic and Latino communities, was canceled last year due to the COVID-19 pandemic, so this month's return was important. Christy had her marketing team include a question with registration. Have you been vaccinated?
All of a sudden, I had a few calls. It became an issue. This guy posted it on social media platform and they started coming against us just for a stupid question. For the sake of our organization and our event, we decided just to remove the question. No big deal.
Christy wasn't expecting that reaction.
You've got local government doing one thing, state government doing another thing. And then look at our governor, who just really is so out of touch with the people that he serves, and then the federal government and all the resistance. So there's a lot of people that are just confused and that they're going off of misinformation.
The Hispanic community leader says that the response that she received shows underlying issues that she says is affecting the vaccination rate among communities of color. About a quarter of Lubbock's Hispanic population is vaccinated, according to the latest data from the state's health department. Around 36% of all Hispanic Texans are vaccinated. The lower vaccination rate has some local leaders concerned.
I'm scared to death that that's going to repeat itself.
At a recent city news conference, Dr. Craig Ryan, the chief medical officer of Covenant Health, recalled how the Hispanic population was more adversely affected by COVID last year.
And for reasons unbeknownst to me, our Hispanic population is one of the more resistant to getting the vaccine. We've got to get that message out. This is really hurting them more than everybody else.
Chico James has an idea about what is causing the hesitation. He's one of the page administrators for the North Lubbock Facebook group. In the predominantly Hispanic North Lubbock, Chico says that the way the community has been treated over the years has created distrust.
If it's government officials who are urging you to get vaccinated, and you know that the government in your state has spent all of its time figuring out ways to harm you, by gerrymandering and so forth, then why should you trust the government?
Chico gives credit to the local leadership for trying to do the right thing in a hard situation, but says that ultimately some of the residents in the area don't know who to trust.
They've done horrible things like trying to close up all the schools in Central, North, and East Lubbock and on and on through the years. If that's the context, then some small percentage is going to have a distrust of what people in authority have to say.
In the past month, as the spread of the coronavirus again increased in the community, just over 16,000 COVID-19 vaccine shots were administered in Lubbock County. For Texas Tech Public Media, I'm Jamie Lozano.
Now we move to a very controversial local government decision. Starting next year, plastic bags will disappear from most Las Cruces retailers after a vote by the Las Cruces City Council. But the new law also requires a 10-cent bag fee for paper bags, and store owners will have to share the revenue with the city and file reports tracking the use of paper bags. Some thoughts on this from commentator Walt Rubel.
I don't like plastic bags any more than members of the Las Cruces City Council, who recently passed a ban on them that will start on January 1st. It's not just their uncanny ability to escape confinement and sail into the nearest tree or bush, where they will flap in the breeze until somebody comes along and dislodges them. The health and ecological damages caused by plastic bags goes far beyond just being an eyesore. According to the Center for Biological Diversity, about 730,000 tons of plastic bags, sacks, and wraps were produced in the United States in the year 2015. Less than 13% of that will be recycled. The rest will be dumped in a landfill, or worse, the ocean. Plastics stored in a landfill never fully degrade. Instead, they break down into microplastics, which absorb toxins and present health dangers to both humans and wildlife. We eat, drink, and inhale these microplastics every day without knowing it, according to the Plastics Health Coalition. And so, the Las Cruces City Council was responding to a real and growing threat when it voted to ban single-use plastic bags starting next year, with exemptions for things like dry cleaning bags and newspaper wrappers on a rainy day. I understand what they're trying to do and why it needs to be done. If they had passed an ordinance that simply banned the use of plastic bags, my column today would be in full support of that decision. Unfortunately, the ordinance doesn't stop there. It also includes a new fee that will create an unnecessary burden for store owners and an additional cost for shoppers. The ordinance requires that stores charge customers 10 cents a bag for each paper bag they use. Those who qualify for federal food assistance programs would be exempt from the fee. The stores would then be required to file quarterly reports with the city on how many bags were given away for free and how many 10-cent fees were collected. The city and the store would then split that money evenly. City Sustainability Officer Lisa LaRoque explained during a recent radio interview that the fee is intended to encourage people to bring their own reusable cloth bags with them each time they shop. And maybe a 10-cent reminder will have that effect on some. Beyond that, by introducing a new fee as part of this process, members of the city council look like they're trying to gain a financial benefit from something that needs to be done to protect our health and environment. Every new city ordinance doesn't need to be an opportunity to collect a new fee. With this week's commentary, I'm Walt Rubel.
Walt Rubel's opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. More from Las Cruces now. The city's Economic Development Department highlighted local unemployment trends during this week's council meeting, and the city and the state fall far behind the national recovery. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
In a presentation to the Las Cruces City Council, Economic Development Deputy Director Francisco Pajares reported on the current state of city unemployment. The Las Cruces unemployment rate was 7.9% in June, down 2 percentage points when compared to June 2020. The percentage is still higher than June 2019 numbers, when unemployment was at 6.3%.
The city of Las Cruces is recovering from the negative economic effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. We are recovering. However, about 6,000 individuals are still filing for unemployment insurance in Doñana County.
The City Economic Development Deputy Director says the current unemployment numbers don't accurately tell the entire story, in part due to a reluctance by some to seek employment during a public health crisis.
We have a specific situation in which individuals are, in some instances, deliberately not going out to seek employment. They're seeking employment because they have to, but they're not necessarily going out and getting the jobs, right? It's quite an interesting phenomenon.
Councillor Ioana Bencomo says a lack of health protocols for select essential workers has partially led to a reluctance to enter the current workforce.
We are still very much in a pandemic where we are asking people to show up to work and there isn't enough safety protocols, there isn't enough of an incentive for people to actually feel safe at work from getting sick from COVID. And then on top of that, many of these workers probably don't have health insurance.
At the height of the pandemic, approximately 12,000 Doñana County residents filed unemployment insurance claims, a number that has since been cut in half. Payera says those unemployment benefits are currently set to expire in early September. They'll emphasize that a lack of benefits might not be enough to sufficiently increase employment within the county.
We have to keep an eye out for September once these benefits expire. We'll see what the labor market does. In Texas and in El Paso, the benefits were already expired, and they're still struggling to find people. So this doesn't necessarily tell you that it's because of the benefits, but rather because of other things that may be affecting it.
While prices have collectively risen across the United States, Payera says Las Cruces remains competitive with other American cities, which could potentially attract more residents to Las Cruces.
Prices are going up. We are still competitive compared to other places in the nation, because prices are going up everywhere, not just in Las Cruces. But when we compare ourselves to everyone else, we're still competitive in terms of prices.
2020 census data for the city of Las Cruces shows an increase in the population by around 14%. Councillor Ioana Bencomo wants to ensure that Las Cruces continues to grow, advocating for the city to explore ways to reduce the cost of living.
People moved here. People wanted to live in Las Cruces, and I want to make sure that we do as much as possible to keep that desire to want to live here and ensure that people, everyone from workers to single parents to young families, they want to stay here.
Toward the end of the meeting, Mayor Ken Miyagashima offered ideas to cut down cost of living expenses, largely focusing on utilities.
Just a couple ideas. One would be community solar. So we can do that. Then I'm hoping that it would reduce our residents, those residents that participate, approximately 20% less on their electric bill. Another one is I wanted to look at increasing the franchise fee from El Paso Electric, that 1%.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
Well, the economic picture is improving for most U.S. states, but as we just heard, Las Cruces and New Mexico, far behind the national picture, and many in the state see the Biden administration's jobs plan and focus on climate as a way to transform our economy. The New Mexico News Connection's Roz Brown reports.
In a state that relies on oil and gas for about 40% of its economy, new jobs with a focus on infrastructure are welcome news. Amy Miller is the owner of AAM Consulting and a lifelong New Mexican who has spent much of her career in the energy industry. Like many western states, New Mexico is seeing more impacts from climate change, including the length and intensity of forest fires. And Miller says it's time to prioritize.
From an economic perspective, from a climate perspective, we got to get to the table and figure this stuff out. Time is running out.
I'm Roz Brown.
In focus on KRWG News this week, a conversation with J.J. Amaworo-Wilson. He is the editorial director of the brand new Membris Press in Silver City. We'll talk about changes in publishing and the upcoming Southwest Word Fiesta. But first, his full-time job as writer-in-residence at Western New Mexico University.
Well, firstly, Fred, it's great to be back on the program. Great to see you again. Thank you ever so much for inviting me. As a writer in residence, my primary role, of course, is to write and to publish, but I also do a number of other things. I meet with students to help them improve their writing. I meet with faculty members to help them get their work published. I judge competitions. I organize literary events, organize things like readings and book launches, all kinds of things. And at the moment, I'm co-chair of Southwest Word Fiesta, which I know we'll talk about that a little later, but that's also part of my role as writer in residence.
Outstanding. So, yeah. Go ahead.
Thank you. I was just going to say, I'm kind of like a cheerleader for all things literary at the university.
Well, I am ready to hear more about so much, because there's so much that's happened since the last time we talked a number of years ago. You also now have a new role as editorial director for the Mimbres Press at Western New Mexico University. This is a new press. It's a new organization and a new role for you. So tell me about it.
Well, it's an act of great optimism in these times that are difficult for publishers. But Western New Mexico University is dedicated to increasing the intellectual capacities, to bringing out intellectual and cultural elements, particularly of the Southwest. And so we thought that having our own press would be a vehicle for this, publishing great research, publishing works of fiction, works of history, and works about nature, the natural world. So we're just about to start it up. Mimbres Press goes live in September, and as editorial director, I will be in charge of acquiring manuscripts, also setting in motion our own ideas for books, and we're going to represent the whole of the Southwest region. Anything that's of interest in the Southwest, we're going to try and publish. And of course, like all university presses, we'll try and maintain the highest of standards in terms of content, writing, editorial, everything.
Well, I'm sure we'll be talking more about that in the years ahead. Very exciting news. I understand that the first publication is from a Silver City author.
It is. It's a poetry collection called The Algorithm of I. It's written by a magnificent poet called Jack Crocker. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful book. You just have to read it. It's just full of great poems that go through his whole life. He started out in the Deep South, and it's just a wonderful book. And that will come out in September.
I'll look for my copy in the mail so that we can get we can get on that. Well, speaking of new books, JJ, I understand that you have a new novel that's coming out in September as well.
I do. It's called Nazare, N-A-Z-A-R-E. It's all about the toppling of a dictator. It's really a peasant's revolt led by a homeless kid and a washerwoman. It has elements of magical realism. It's set in this kind of non-existent wonderland, but it's kind of quite a revolutionary book, basically all about this dictator who this young boy and this washerwoman attempt to topple. It's a lot of fun, I hope. It's published by PM Press. And it comes out also in September.
Tell me about your process, how you choose a story to write, and then how you develop it. This is really fascinating to somebody like me who just deals in nonfiction all the time, although that can be stranger than fiction, as they say.
Yes. Quite often, the inspiration comes from something you see, just one little thing, or something you hear on the news, something you read. And in my case, for this novel, it was actually the Arab Spring, which was a decade ago, hearing about the Arab Spring and what the people were doing to topple their dictators in Egypt, in Tunisia, and all those countries. So the novel in my head has been brewing, this novel has been brewing for 10 years. But of course, generally, as a writer, you're always on the lookout for interesting little stories. You go around the world and your day-to-day life with very open eyes, and you're just looking for things that interest you and spark off your imagination. It's a beautiful way to live, and of course, if something really does spark your imagination, you end up writing and writing and writing about it.
JJ, I have to ask you this question because I wondered about it just now in your answer there. Living in such a dynamic place as we do, close to the border, and meeting so many interesting people, you're one of the very interesting people I've had a chance to meet in my career, and that's inspirational to me. Is that inspirational to you as a writer of fiction, that where your own environment as well and the people you meet?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Like you say, it's the people you meet. It's also the mixture of cultures here. I live in Silver City in New Mexico. New Mexico generally is just a fascinating place because of all the Hispanic and Mexican influence. Then you have the sort of cowboy influence. Then you have the indigenous influence. And this kind of mezcla, as you say in Spanish, is just fascinating to me. And whenever cultures meet, something new is produced, and it's just something new and interesting. So absolutely, I would agree with you completely, Fred. But also, another inspiration is the Gila itself, the Gila wilderness. If ever you want to get out and see nature, we're right in the middle of it here, and that's always inspiring to me, at least.
It certainly is. I took a trip and finally made it out to the catwalk, that long drive out from Silver City, and what a beautiful place that is, and need to get Absolutely. Back out there as the trees begin to change color and experience our beautiful nature. As if you are not busy enough, you are also the co-chair of the Southwest Word Fiesta, which is coming to Silver City in October. Give us some highlights of this.
Well, yes, October the 22nd to the 24th, we will have the Southwest Word Fiesta. At the moment, it's planned to be a hybrid event, some face-to-face sessions, but mainly online through Zoom. And we just have, as usual, a load of wonderful, wonderful authors. A few from Las Cruces, Brandon Hobson, a wonderful novelist who teaches at NMSU, the amazing Denise Chavez, Connie Voisin, a wonderful poet based in Las Cruces, Rick Bass, who writes fiction and nonfiction. There are so many. We have about 40 authors going to be present. Everything is free. You can find the schedule on our website, which is swwordfiesta.org, swwordfiesta.org, Southwest Word Fiesta. And it's just going to be a wonderful, wonderful event. But even before that, a couple of days before that, we have inaugurated something called Hillerman Day, which honors the work of Tony Hillerman, the famous novelist from Santa Fe, and Anne Hillerman, his daughter, who's also a novelist, and James McGrath Morris, who is Tony Hillerman's biographer. Jamie and Anne will be presenting their work, the biography of Tony Hillerman, and also Anne's new novel. So that'll be, I think that's the 20th, Wednesday the 20th of October. So we have Hillerman Day, and then the festival itself. It's just going to be a great week for anyone who loves literature, books, the written word.
Yes, let's hope that we continue to see improvement, more people getting vaccinated, and so that in-person element can continue, something that we miss as well here at KRWG. Looking at the Word Fiesta and also your work as editorial director of the Mimbrus Press, JJ, give us a sense of developments in the publishing world that are happening right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's never been easier to publish your own work. so many companies, so many individuals are publishing their own work, and there are so many companies out there facilitating that, but it's never been harder to get noticed, to get reviewed, to make any money even. Because obviously, if you make it published, there are going to be more and more books out there, and it's just harder to get for the quality to rise to the top, I guess you could say. So in one way, it's wonderful, because people who've always wanted to be authors, Fred, they have an opportunity. But for professional writers, I think it's become more and more difficult because the market is flooded. So I guess this is in line with many social trends, that things are becoming more democratized because of the internet. So it remains to see how it will play out. But I would say there's some great, great books being published, great books out there. It's a wonderful world for writers and readers. It's just a little harder for full-time professional writers to make a living, I think.
Interesting. And an element of this that I wanted to ask you about, I saw a story the other day with an expert who predicts that textbooks will become a thing of the past very soon, with everything moving online. Of course, some courses this is all already the case. And in the case of non-textbooks, just other books, a lot of folks already read only on devices like Kindles, rather than old-fashioned people like me who like to read on paper once in a while. Where do you see all this going?
I can understand that thought about textbooks, particularly because it's always easier to update things that are online. It's if you want to update a physical book, you have to produce a new edition, which takes time. Whereas when it's online, you can update things and change things rapidly, as you know. Having said that, I do believe the book will survive in a physical form. I think there are enough people who like the technology of the book. And remember, a physical book is also a type of technology. Thousands of years ago, when books were first arriving, people thought they would never last. But actually, the book is the thing that lasts longest. It doesn't need a power source. You can take it to bed with you very easily. You can take it anywhere. And some people just find a great comfort in holding a physical book. I'm one of them, I must say. But then again, I'm of a certain age. So we'll see how it plays out with the younger generations.
Final words for folks who've heard this about these changes. Advice for someone who may be watching, who's thinking about becoming an author or going to school to study with that eventual goal?
My main advice would be this, that all writers begin as readers. Mm-hmm. You have to read a lot in order to learn how to write. So focus on what you're reading, read prolifically, and then writing is a skill like any other skill. You will only improve if you do it a lot. You know, how do you get good at boxing? You throw a lot of punches, you take a lot of punches. The same with writing. You got to do it again and again and again. Don't be frightened of failure. Keep reading, keep writing.
JJ, best of luck with your new role as editorial director of the Mimbres Press at Western New Mexico University, and helping to bring this wonderful Southwest Word Fiesta to our community. It is always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you so much, Fred. It's been a pleasure for me too. Thank you.
Wonderful conversation there with JJ Amaworo-Wilson. And if you missed any of it, you can catch it tomorrow morning at 11 on KRWG-TV. KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. It is so great to be with you. If you ever miss this program, you'll find it anytime in the local radio section at krwg.org. Some experts say profit is behind false information being shared about the 2020 election. Roz Brown reports from the Texas News Service.
David Becker with the Center for Election Innovation and Research says the organizations and news networks that allege President Joe Biden did not defeat Donald Trump by 8 million votes in 2020 are sowing doubt because they've been incentivized to divide the country. And Becker suspects they're doing it to raise money from Trump supporters disappointed by the outcome.
We are now getting to the point where we are in perpetual doubt about election outcomes and perpetual doubt about the legitimacy of those elected in verified, confirmed elections.
By not accepting verified election results, Becker says people are making the case that democracy no longer serves United States citizens. Many Republicans reject the 2020 results, believing there was election fraud, although state election officials from both political parties have said there's no evidence of widespread fraud or other irregularities. Becker says ongoing threats against election officials and their families also work to delegitimize election outcomes and destabilize democracy. He cites a survey by the Bipartisan Policy Center and the Brennan Center for Justice that found 1 in 3 election officials feel unsafe in their jobs. Becker warns America could lose a generation of professionalism and expertise in election administration.
And we are seeing an exodus of experienced election officials from both parties. This is of great concern, particularly as we're now seeing some of the election deniers actually run for Secretary of State in places like Nevada, Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, etc.
The Brennan Center report also found 1 in 5 election officials said they're concerned about death threats, while half said the explosion of disinformation about elections has made their jobs more dangerous. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
Speaking of elections, we leave you with perhaps the most important story of the week, but one that was largely overlooked in the media. Every Democrat in the U.S. House voted this week for legislation aimed at protecting voting rights, with all Republicans voting against the measure. The bill, named for the late Georgia Congressman and civil rights leader John Lewis, would strengthen the Voting Rights Act of 1965. The U.S. Supreme Court has issued rulings over the last decade weakening that law. Houston Congresswoman Sylvia Garcia said on the House floor the bill is critical as states move to enact new voting restrictions.
Recent attempts by the GOP-led legislatures in states like my home state of Texas demonstrate how urgent it is to protect our democracy.
No Republicans voted for the measure. GOP Congressman Jody Arrington of Lubbock said it's federal overreach.
We don't need federal government lawyers or the DOJ to be weaponized against states' efforts to make these reforms with respect to voter ID and mail-in ballot eligibility.
The bill will now be taken up by the U.S. Senate. President Joe Biden says it's an urgent priority. That's KRWG News This Week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for being with us. If you ever missed the program on the radio, no worries, we have you covered. You can find it anytime in the local radio section at krwg.org. KRWG Public Media, the New Mexico Broadcasters Association Station of the Year, broadcasting from New Mexico State University, KRWG Las Cruces, and KRXG Silver City. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.